Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Well, as we've been saying, Election Day is just 2 weeks away from tomorrow. And Massachusetts Republicans see the Tierney to Say race in the 6th District as their best hope for congressional win.
2 years ago, the GOP center of attention was a bit further south, in the 4th District, when Republican Sean Bealot gave Congressman Barney Frank a run for his money. Well, this time around, Bealot is back. He's not running against Frank, but another heavyweight Massachusetts name, Joseph Kennedy III. Sean Bealot joins us now to talk about how he's looking at these last 2 weeks of the race. Sean Bealot, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can call in with your questions for Sean Bealot. He is running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District, so that if that's your district, what are the issues that you want your congressman to focus on when he goes to Washington? What are your questions for Sean Bealot? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at radioboston.org. And we should note that we have extended an invitation to Joe Kennedy III, and we do anticipate and hope that he will join us before Election Day on November 6th. So, Mr. Bealot, let's start with one thing that has emerged in the debates that you've had so far with Joe Kennedy III, and that is that you've repeatedly and forcefully said that you don't believe he possesses qualifications for the job of congressman. Specifically, why not?
Well, I don't think you'd find any other candidate out there with only 2.5 years work experience that people would take seriously, quite frankly.
So you don't think the Peace Corps is serious work experience?
I don't think most other candidates with his background would be taken seriously. Before he got in the race, a lot of the media especially thought that he was the front runner, and that wasn't because of his background. That wasn't because of his accomplishments or his issues. It was because he's named Kennedy. The reason he's been able to raise $4 million is because of his last name. I think that is an issue in the race. I don't think that anybody would consider him qualified without that credential.
I do wonder, though, there is a line of thinking that would say that why isn't someone, I mean, those years of experience that you're talking about, he served as a prosecutor. He was defending, I mean, he was prosecuting crimes and representing victims in courts of law. And the Peace Corps experience as well. I mean, he's gone out and, in fact, you know, you could say that the Peace Corps is a good proxy for what a representative of government might eventually do one day in sort of taking interests and needs of quote-unquote constituents and trying to actually do something practical about it. You don't think that a public service is good preparation for public service?
Sure, but not that little public service. So, I mean, honestly, imagine if a Republican got in this race without that name, but with those credentials, no one would take him seriously. That's just what it is. If you can do that thought experiment, I think, you know, you'll come to that conclusion. Additionally, let's say, you know, he does have the qualifications. Then why hasn't he gone on radio or on TV, been a guest on any shows? Why hasn't he gone out and done town halls? I've done dozens of TV and radio appearances. I've done 15 town halls. He sent a cameraman to everyone, so he knows what I've been saying. He has not gone out in public, and he's done a lot of photo opportunities, and he's done a good job of that, getting out in different places, taking a photo or two, and heading home. But if he has something beyond that, you know, if those couple years of work experience are sufficient, then he should get out and defend his record. He shouldn't just, you know, kind of play it safe for 10 months.
Mm. Well, on the other hand, in your 2010 run, you were running against an incumbent, a very well-known name, Barney Frank, not Kennedy, but Congressman Frank had been in Congress for a long time. And nevertheless, you were still able to raise, what, over $2 million, much of which came from support from outside of the state. So you would think that the odds would have been even more heavily stacked against you in 2010, but you were able to draw a lot of money. You haven't been able to draw that much money this time around. You mentioned Joe Kennedy's almost $3.8 million. You've been able to pull in, what, $760,000?
A bit more, yeah.
Or so? So, I mean, is name recognition all that's going on here? That, to me, that doesn't really work because...
Well, my fundraising compares well to most races across the country. Now, in this race, it doesn't. I will say part of the problem is that the media called this one very early. back this spring in April or March, you can find articles saying, you know, Kennedy's going to win in a landslide. They haven't been paying attention to the race. That makes it harder to get those small dollar donations that we've been depending on. You know, he's raised $300,000 from PACs. We haven't. He's raised a couple hundred thousand from registered lobbyists. We haven't. And part of the reason for that is because of the coverage of the race, the assumptions that a Kennedy can't be beat in Massachusetts, the assumption that a Republican isn't going to be competitive in this race. But when you poll voters, they don't think those things. When you poll voters, among those who have decided firmly who they're going to vote for, we're neck and neck. Among those who haven't, there's a lot of leaners in his direction, but he also has a 100% name ID. And so when you look at the numbers from January to today, they've hardly moved. So he's outspent me 4-5-1. He's got a name that everyone in the district knows. And after 10 months, the numbers haven't changed hardly at all.
We'll dig into the issues here in just a moment, but there's one sort of purely political question also that I'd just like to ask you. And that's a sense, something that people who are born and bred in the 4th might think, and that is both you and Mr. Kennedy. I know the term carpetbagger has been thrown around. You left the 4th District after 2010 for a couple years to Pennsylvania.
No, for 4 months. In the fall of 2011, I was back. For 4 months.
I wanted to give you a chance to sort of clarify why the back and forth.
Yeah. So in the last trimester of my wife's pregnancy, we had a baby born last November 14th. And when we had our first child, we had some difficulties and we had reason to believe that those might occur again. And so we decided it made sense to be near family, near my wife's family for the last 3 months. We stayed through the holidays. We came back. So 4 months away, I think most people would consider that a vacation more than a carpetbagging move. I've lived in the district for about 5 years. That's not as long as some people. It's a lot longer than others. It wasn't an issue in 2010, and I don't think it's an issue this time either.
I'm speaking to Sean Bielut. He is the Republican challenger in the congressional race in Massachusetts' 4th district. That is the district currently represented by Democrat Barney Frank. Sean Bielut's running against Joseph Kennedy III. So this is your chance to ask him questions about the man who wants to represent you. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK with your questions for Sean Bielut. So Mr. Bielut, let's dig into some of the issues which I know that you've talked about all over the campaign trail and in the debates. And why don't we first start with something that's an issue kind of across the board from the local, state, and to the federal level, and that is the role of government in general in Americans' lives. Because I've heard you say, quote, that we need to get people who have actually worked in business, who have experience to understand what works and what doesn't. I mean, those are the kind of people that you think we need in Washington. So is it safe for me to presume that you believe that fundamentally the free market works and that that's the kind of thinking that we need more in Washington?
I think most Americans believe that the free market works. The question is how much we involve it in public policy and public solutions. And I think the pendulum swung too far away from the market. Now, that doesn't mean it's, you know, this isn't binary. This isn't, you know, we either have totally free markets or we have total government control. That we're not talking about that. We're talking about what is our starting point for solutions. And in my belief is that things are most economically sustainable and you get better outcomes if you rely on market forces as much as you can. And then after those have reached their peak potential, that's when you get involved with the government. If you start prior to that, you destroy value.
So on that note, isn't one of the greatest interruptions to the free market corporate welfare that comes from the federal government? Because wouldn't you think...
I don't disagree.
Yeah, so I mean, this is one thing which stacks the decks against small businesses more than anything.
Sure,
so
absolutely.
As a congressman, would you try to go after reductions
absolutely.
In corporate welfare?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's absurd. I think we should have a fairer, flatter code. That means you're going to get rid of some subsidies and loopholes that disproportionately benefit large corporations. I think they cause market distortions. I don't think they're healthy for us as a country.
What about reducing government spending? That's also a claim.
Oh, absolutely.
What specifically, though, would you reduce?
Well, all sorts of things. So first, you need entitlement reform to save those programs. Anybody who tells you you don't need to reform is putting those programs at risk.
Does that mean that you support the Romney-Ryan Medicare plan 100%?
Not 100%. And I doubt that anybody out there who's saying that I support it 100% supports it 0%. It's a good starting point. Let's start the discussion there. And if somebody wants to introduce opposite proposal, an opposing set of ideas, that's fantastic. Let's have that discussion instead of, you know, Sean Bielad and anybody who supports the Paul Ryan plan wants to end Medicare as we know it. You know, that's scare tactics. But let's have a rational conversation about it.
So if not 100%, then which part do you support?
Well, what I like is the idea of pushing a little bit further towards market-based solutions. Now, under the Ryan plan that he put together with Ron Wyden, a pretty liberal senator from former Oregon.
Who has backed away from it since, though.
Yeah, he has, and I think that's largely political, frankly. Presidential year, that doesn't surprise me that, you know, both parties would play party games. But essentially, it says recipients of Medicare can choose to stay on the current system, or they can take subsidy for premiums. That's an interesting idea. Maybe it's not perfect. Maybe we have to play with it. But let's have the discussion about what we should do rather than just say, no, if you touch it, you know, you're imperiling those on Medicare. You know, so the Congressional Budget Office has projected that in the year 2033, Social Security will no longer be solvent. My daughter will be a junior in college. My son will have just graduated. They won't have entered the workforce, and Social Security will be insolvent. That's unacceptable. We as Americans think that Social Security is a valuable program. We want it for future generations. That means we need to reform it today. That's entitlements. I think we need to move away from the scare tactics, the demagoguery, and get both parties at the table proposing real solutions.
But on that point, I mean, I hear you say scare tactics and demagoguery, and there are, you know, studies across the board that you can pick and choose to decide what to, you know, what does and doesn't support a particular political viewpoint. But it's not, I mean, there is no dispute that in part the Ryan plan for Medicare, for example, includes, you know, they call it premium support, other people call it vouchers. But the truth is that these quote-unquote vouchers for Medicare would be pegged to the rate of inflation, whereas the cost of health care is going up at many times the rate of inflation. So that money is going to have to come out of the pockets of people who are on this voucher plan. And I was looking at the Kaiser Family Foundation, who did a pretty deep analysis of, they asked a hypothetical, what if this plan was put into effect today? And they found that 90% of current Medicare recipients in Massachusetts would end up paying quite a bit out of pocket on the Romney Ryan plan.
Well, first of all, I believe that was the version that didn't allow people to stay on the current plan. Second, you know, there was a proposal to index it based on inflation. There was a proposal to index it based on GDP growth. There's different ways to index it. And so fixating on one particular form of, you know, indexing, I don't think is, you know, the right argument to be had. The argument to be had is, look, do we go this direction? Or do we go the direction of the Affordable Care Act, which takes $700 billion out of Medicare and forces it through the funnel of Obamacare, essentially? I don't think that that's a good solution. I don't think most Americans want to see that happen. And I think we need to have a mature discussion that isn't just driven by party politics and, oh, it's the Ryan plan, so I can't support any aspect of it. And, you know, get around to solutions and real policy discussions.
We got a lot of people who want to ask you some questions.
Excellent.
So let me let them in. Kathleen's calling from Newton. You're on the air, Kathleen.
I was listening earlier about experience, and it's very important to me because I feel like with a congressman going out who had a lot of seniority, we're really interviewing somebody for this job. And I am undecided, but I've hired a lot of people. And so if I had the two resumes side by side and I covered the top of the page, it isn't, I think the question is, how can you handle things as they come up? And I know that I saw somewhere that Sean Bielad had worked for iRobot, and that's a company I have heard from, I mean, heard of. It's a Massachusetts company. I'd love to know more about what he did there, what they worked on. Did it solve problems? Can he develop plans? I understand what the Joseph Kennedy did. You know, as an assistant district attorney, that is pretty clear-cut. You know what those people do. But I don't know what Sean did at iRobot, and I'd like to know more about that and how long he was there.
Kathleen, thanks for your call. Let's turn the question to Sean Bielad.
Sure. First, slightly off the question, but kind of related, is as you look at this race, one other thing to consider as you're choosing between two potential freshman congressmen is that I would be in the majority party. If you're thinking about what would be most effective for the district and the state, it behooves us as a state to have people in the majority party working with the rest of the congressional delegation. But in terms of what I did at iRobot, I was director of business development for a few years, and then I ran a $100 million product line, 100-person product line of defense robots used to go after roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, the program was success. It's successful. It's the most widely fielded ground robot in the world, literally saving lives. A number of the towns around here have them as well. Wellesley used one a few years ago to go after a suspicious device in a phone booth. Great technology and a real example of what works, you know, building on Massachusetts know-how, Massachusetts technology that was spun out of MIT. We have great opportunities here in this state in particular to grow our economy, you know, using the resources that are unique to the area. And I think if we get people in Washington who have experience in business, who understand what a government should do and shouldn't do, there's a lot of benefit to us at this particular point in history. I don't intend to go down there and stay for a career, but I think right now, having somebody with a business background and a national security background makes a lot of sense.
Jack is calling from Framingham. You're on the air, Jack.
Yeah, hi. I'm a retired doctor, a non-businessman, but I have common sense. When I heard that Congress, I think it was Christmas Eve, repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, I said, this is going to be a problem. Now, with 2020 hindsight, we know it was a bad problem. How would you work to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act?
Thank you so much for your call, Jack, and I think he's referring to the Glass-Steagall Act.
Right. Of course, you know, we do have Dodd-Frank in place now, so that it wouldn't be as simple as reinstating the act. I think Dodd-Frank, though, is largely the opposite of what we need. I shouldn't say the opposite. When in a 2,000-page bill, there's going to be good stuff, there's going to be bad stuff. But we know, for example, that we're pushing a lot of community banks out of a competitive standing. More and more business is going to big banks. That wasn't intended, but it has happened. We know it's harder for people to get mortgages or refinance their houses, despite the fact that they have greater equity and they have payment records. They're having trouble refinancing because of some of the restrictions that Dodd-Frank has placed on lending institutions and other financial institutions. We know that we have a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that is funded through the Fed, so it doesn't have direct supervision by the Congress in direct year-to-year oversight, and it's headed by a six-year appointee. So once that person's in there just isn't a whole lot of accountability, and it has a broad mandate that can touch almost any aspect, almost any financial transaction.
So would you rather have that Consumer Financial Protection Agency not exist then?
Either not exist or be subject to congressional oversight. I think it's a dangerous thing. If you like the person who's in charge and it's your party, great. If you don't like the person who's in charge and it's not your party, all our executive branch people should be in some way accountable to voters.
I mean, isn't that true for every executive appointee, though?
Most don't go over 6 years, and most of them have to come directly to Congress for their appropriations. This bureau is unique in both respects.
We're running out of time here, Sean Bila. It's been a very interesting conversation. But I do wonder, one thing which was touched upon in our political roundtable as they were wrapping up, and it is on the minds of a lot of voters here, is that, you know, there's constantly this call for bipartisanship, and people really desire that in Washington in terms of, you know, trying to take steps forward together as a country. But on the other hand, you know, maybe a well-reasoned cynic might think that is just not possible, because the two parties are so far apart. Do you think that there's anything that you can do if you were to be sent to Washington to you know, act in a bipartisan way, and would you make a commitment to do so, and how specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real challenge. The other day when we were in a joint editorial board and this question was asked, Joe said no, he thinks that we should have all Democrats in Congress and that we'll get better outcomes that way. I disagree. I think that very few things are black and white. I think very few things are binary in choices. I think that there are pragmatic solutions to most of the public policy problems that we face today. I think you go after those solutions and you forget about, you know, which party is saying what, and you agree where it makes sense, just like you would in the real world. Congress should be no different than how you interact in your business or among your neighbors or whatever else. It sounds like that's the music and I got to go. But
yeah, I was also thinking that a lot of people out there, sometimes myself included, think that Congress is as far from the real world as we can get.
That's unfortunately the case. Yeah.
Sean Bielot is a Republican candidate in the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
today.
You.
Listeners, stay with us because coming up, examining the courage that it takes to say, I don't know. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.